Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last time we were talking about Tudor towns, and I wanted to close on one or two reflections about those and then press on and look at the position in the Stuart period, or at least start the Stuart period. And the point I want to make really in sort of thinking about the Tudor period is a broader one. And this is the question, as ever in history, of the relationship between continuity and change. I think it's fair to say that in the public domain, the emphasis tends to be on change, and people are expected to produce revolutionary new theories about why something or other is supposedly a turning point. And the reality of life, of course, is that continuity can continue, and that in many senses, change actually interacts rather than being in kind of some antagonistic relationship. I mean, interestingly, there you have a tension between not just popular and academic views, but also I think the popular view is one more commonly held on the left, Marxist-derived view, whereas, you know, if you think about the past or the present, you'll be aware of continuities as well as change. So, you know, the most abrupt level, I suppose, with people at the present moment talking about climate change, yes, the climate is increasing, and yes, there are serious implications, and yes, we need to think through those implications. At the same time, it is not the end of human life on Earth, and it is not on the scale of some cataclysm that is sometimes described as if the species was coming to the end in moments of time. So one has to always think about how to reconcile the two. And I suppose what I was rather thinking that if you look at Tudor towns, I'm not implying there was an absence of change. Clearly there was change, and I emphasised the role of the Reformation. But what I wanted to argue is that change was limited by powerful constraints and or part of a rhythmic character of activity rather than one of exponential change. We tend in our modern world to think of change in an exponential fashion, and often as unidirectional. And that tends to be the standard narratives of change that are offered. But, and I'm, without implying that those are in some way flawed or wrong, one could argue also that there are other aspects of change, rhythmic change, as it were, the change on the pattern of the day or the year, or indeed notions of Malthusian constraints in some respect. And I think there's a degree to which urban circumstances should be considered in this light, as indeed England as a whole should be in the 16th century, despite the disruption of what some academics call early modernity. Don't know whether the people of those days were aware of themselves as being early in that respect. So, for example, there are arguments about the precursors of the Industrial Revolution, on which, of course, I've written a book, which include discussion about long-term growth rates that go back to the Tudor period, notably in the steadily rising use of coal, including for industrial process. And that approach provides a way to look at exponential change with towns, for example, providing services to this process of industrial change. And it's also possible to see agricultural change in that respect. And all three, industrial, commercial, and agricultural purposes and elements interacted. As well, of course, in demographic terms, as I mentioned last week, the population saw significant growth in the 16th century, and certainly dramatic growth compared to the situation in the late 14th and 15th. And this growth was to continue into the early 17th. But I think I would say that the crises, the multiple crises, some of which I mentioned last week of the 1590s, provided many warnings of serious weaknesses in economy, society, governance, and politics, and scarcely suggested exponential change towards some highland of improvement. And these problems, these weaknesses, affected the experience of urban life for many. Well, same is true, obviously, of its rural counterpart. Indeed, I mean, it's worth saying that the bleakness of the rural situation helped explain why there are so many migrants to towns, migrants who were then, in some respects, a key driver, not the key driver. Do notice words are used with care, a key driver of urban society, and whose assimilation gave it a character of tension as well as opportunity. The same is true today, and you could argue that that, again, is part of the rhythmic character of change that I was referring to. And if this is true of a number of periods, that ironically, of course, captures the continuities of urban history. So it's at that, against that background, that I want to move and start our discussion of the 17th century, the Stuart age, Stuart dynasty, of course, 1603, accession of James VI of Scotland as James I of England, and the dynasty finishes on the throne with the death of Queen Anne in 1714. I want to start with two quotes, because I suppose they capture the differences that one can be thinking of, and there are many other differences. The first is from the famous diarist John Evelyn. I'm also going to be quoting at some stage another John Evelyn, who was a traveller and whose letters I found in the manuscript division of the British Library. Anyway, this is the famous diarist writing on the Great Frost Fair of London of 1683 to 84. So, you know, the river was frozen over. And for those of you who are interested in the river, you will know that the parameters of the river changed in the 19th century when it was in effect canalised by Bazalgette, and that increased the flow and made it far less likely that it would ever freeze. But prior to that, the river was on the whole shallower and slower, and that made it easier to freeze. Here we go. Streets of booths were set upon the Thames, all sorts of trades and shops furnished and full of commodities. Coaches plied on the Thames, full from Westminster to the Temple, and from several other stairs. These are the water stairs that go down to the river. You can still see one near the embankment. To and fro, as in the streets, sledges sliding with skates, a bull baiting, horse and coach races, puppet plays and interludes, cooks tippling and other lewd places, so that it seemed to be a bacchanalian triumph or carnival on the water. I mean, I think what that captures is the entrepreneurial nature of urban life. I mean, John Evelyn, of course, who could be a bit po-faced about so many things, and was certainly no Samuel Pepys, commenting on lewd places. Well, you can imagine many of the people of the time being quite happy to have some lewd places. But the captures the entrepreneurialness. Now, here we then go to something else, which is a different aspect, a more troubling aspect of entrepreneurialism. This is from James Vernon in the manuscript division again. He was a confidential figure in the offices of the Secretaries of State, and he was writing at a time of weather-related dearth. In other words, shortage of food and also, sort of high prices. Actually, I made a mistake. It's not the British Library. It's actually, I just looked it up quickly in my notes, the Beinecke Library, where I found it, which is a manuscript library at in Yale. And this is from the papers of William Blathwaite, who becomes, is ennobled as Portland. No, he's not ennobled as Portland. I'm just trying to remember his title. He gets the house at Durham Park, which you can still visit, National Trust property, and he's William III's most confidential advisor. Yes, he is ennobled as Portland. Here we go. The insolence of the common people has risen to a great height about the carrying out of corn, especially at Worcester, So in other words, the people dislike the idea that at a time of high prices of food, food should be moved out of their community and into other communities, where they not only forced the prisons to let out some of their companions that were committed for these riots, but they went in a body where they heard there was a great magazine of corn, which they took away and sold it by proclamation for 2 shillings per bushel. So in other words, what you've got there is a tension. I mean, historians called it the moral economy of the crowd. There are other ways of looking at that. But what one has got in this case is entrepreneurialism, activism of a very different form. And Worcester in 1693, so that's after the Glorious Revolution, after the period when, as it were, people are supposed to have been all happier and jollier and all the rest of it. But in fact, the 1690s, like the 1590s, were another decade of absolute crisis. Also, to be true, of course, of the 1790s. Anyway, the most dramatic aspect of the 17th century for towns, as indeed for English society as a whole, was that of war. This was a period of civil warfare of unprecedented scale for England, not of unprecedented length, but of an unprecedented scale. Already in 1638 to 1640, a breakdown in relations with Scotland, where the bishops' wars had broken out, had led to increased attention to fortified border towns in northern England, and justifiably so, as the Scots advanced and forced their way across the River Tyne in 1640. A surviving plan of Newcastle in 1638 showed the defences of the town, including the hills that commanded it, as the latter helped establish its vulnerability to cannon. In other words, even before the Civil War, people were having to think about the defendability of towns. The First Civil War, so-called later, between Charles I and Parliament, followed in 1642 to 1646, the second in 1648, and there was renewed large-scale fighting in England in 1651, when Charles II unsuccessfully invaded, getting as far as Worcester, where he was crushed, well, not he personally, his army. In the First Civil War, Parliament found particular backing in London and many of the large towns. At the same time, there was frequently a divide between towns and hinterlands, one that drew on existing divisions. So, for example, prior to the war, life in Dorchester and Dorset reflected the tensions between Puritanism and the crown. But alongside significant opposition in many towns, there were also important signs of urban support for Charles I, for example, when he entered London in November 1641 and when he entered Lincoln in July 1642. Divisions in towns reflected, between royalists and parliamentarians, reflected social structures, religious affiliations, political commitments, ideological stances, as well as the role, understandably, an important role of personalities and contingencies. And prior to the war, these could be expressed through performative civic activism. So, you know, it's a lovely phrase. I like to use that phrase if I want to talk academic ease. I mean, it actually includes things like riots as well as pageantry. Beating up somebody is a form of performative civic activism, though I don't suggest you try that one at the magistrates' courts as your defence. The cost of government demands, notably from the 1620s, as well as the pressures, and most famously ship money in the 1630s, as well as the pressures arising from ecclesiastical policies in the shape, especially of the Arminianism of Archbishop William Laud, increased the strains on consensus in what was already for many towns a complex dance of collaboration and contention, one that affected relations between crown and towns, as well as within the latter. But at the same time, the causes of disruption did not solely come from the crown. I mean, usually people say it's all the other people's fault. If they hadn't adopted this policy, everything would have been perfect. Actually, it's very rarely as simple as that. So, for example, in Kidderminster, The Puritans, who included the clothiers, were opposed by conservatives, who were comprised more of journeymen, in other words, more poorer workmen, and they were fearful of Puritan moves against their public sociability of drinking and processions. You could even think that there are modern parallels in this situation. This pre-war tension in Kidderminster became wartime division, and some Puritans, such as the famous preacher Richard Baxter, left the town. While Kidderminster, in other words, ended up as royalist, which is why Baxter had to leave, many towns, for example, Blackburn, Bolton, Exeter, Gloucester, Hull, Leicester, London, Lyme Regis, Manchester, Plymouth, Reading and Taunton, all backed Parliament. And this situation, and in all of those cases, apart from London, I think you could say their hinterland supported Charles, this situation, at once local and regional, encouraged the royalists to try to seize these towns as part of their national strategy, but also separate to it. And much of the war, indeed, was local, as is normally the case in civil wars. But also there were more significant strategic factors. So key bridging points made towns major centres for conflict, notably Gloucester, Worcester and Preston, with battles at the last two and a major siege at the first. The same was true for ports, such as Lyme Regis, Plymouth and Hull, all of which were besieged by the royalists, but which could obtain supplies by sea and were able to hold out. As in the Wars of the Roses, holding towns could prove fruitless in the event of defeat in battle in the field. So the parliamentarians lost Lichfield after the Battle of Hopton Heath in 1643, or more significantly, the royalists lost York after defeat at nearby Marston Moor in 1644. But despite this, many towns had to be stormed. For example, Bristol in 1643 and Leicester in 1645, both by the royalists. And it was only necessary for those storming a city to find one weak place in order to break through. Other towns fell to siege, as Exeter did to the royalists in 43, York to the parliamentarians in 44, and Hereford to the parliamentarians in 46, or they successfully resisted siege, as did Coventry, Gloucester, Hull, Lyme Regis and Plymouth when besieged by the royalists. The war saw much new fortification. So, for example, in parliamentarian Gloucester and Northampton and royalist Worcester, surviving medieval walls were supplemented by new fortifications. The castle in Newcastle was refortified. Other towns saw new works. In particular, London, the key urban support for the parliamentary cause, notably in taxation, loans and recruits, was protected by major new fortifications built in 1642 to 43 and far more extensive than the walls. A lot of Londoners went out and built these essentially earthen banks and forts, which were, I mean, there's a map of them in my long history of London. They were an impressive feat, which has left singularly little legacy compared to, obviously, the stoneworks of the medieval wall, and prior to that, its Roman antecedents. Defences didn't see any action at all, but they were felt necessary as a result of the advance of the Royalist army as far as Turnham Green in 1642, just to the west of London. There was much damage to many towns, as I said, not to London, but towns that underwent major sieges. So, for example, Newark, a royalist siege. It repelled sieges in 1643 and 44, but in 1645 to 46, a six-month siege led to hunger and was accompanied by outbreaks of typhus and the plague that killed about 1,000 people before the town surrendered. A third of Taunton was destroyed in its two sieges. And the economic base of towns could also be hit hard, as with Exeter, Gloucester and Reading, the last of which changed hands frequently. It was the major town between royalist capital of Oxford and the parliamentary capital of London. Towns, obviously, that experienced sieges and or seizures were hit, but so also was the economic base of other towns. Civil wars are not generally good for economic activity. There was also more specific damage when, for example, Chester surrendered in 1646. The victorious parliamentarians vandalised the cathedral, breaking the stained glass and damaging the organ and much else. Ely Cathedral had been vandalised 2 years before. A battle at Great Torrington in 1646 in Devon led to the destruction of the church and of many buildings. And I think it's fair to say that there was probably more devastation to English towns than there had been in previous civil conflicts, because although fire had been a major hazard in previous ones, deliberately setting fires, there'd been no similar use of gunpowder. Gunpowder was used in the Wars of the Roses, but not on the scale in which it was used in the 1640s. There was also organised privation, even destruction, which focused on towns. In 1643, Prince Rupert, a leading royalist commander, ordered nearby parish constables to provide labour for fortifying Towcester, adding, "In no ways fail, as you will answer the country at your utmost peril, as the total plundering and burning of your houses, with what other mischiefs the hungry soldiers can inflict upon you." Indeed, the onerous demands of garrisons, such as Hereford and Langport, led to the clubman movement in 1644, as local people in the Welsh marches and the Welsh West Country sought to keep troops out. Now, that might not appear relevant to a history of towns, but obviously these troops were essentially urban garrisons, garrisons based in towns, going into the countryside to seize goods for their support, for food for themselves, for food for the animals and for timber. And, you know, this did not go down very well in the surrounding rural areas. I would argue there's no comparable damage or loss in English society, urban or rural, until the 20th century. There was disruption, but not comparable loss. And indeed, after the war, as a result of the conflict, there were many who were left widowed or fatherless. For example, 56% of the Gloucester apprentices in 1653. The strains of the war pressed very hard on the population, but townspeople were more exposed than people in the countryside to conscription, to seizures of goods, to taxation and to billeting, and their churches, clergy and religious observances were far more under scrutiny and regulation. So, for example, in Norwich, a parliamentary city throughout the war, there was iconoclasm, the prohibition of Christmas Day as a festival, and an assault on guild days as festivals. And these strains contributed to royalist rioting there in 1648, as well as helping outline a subsequent topography of political commitment in the city, those areas that were most committed to radicalism tended to be those areas that had been particularly puritanical, and royalist areas conversely. The prohibition of Christmas celebrations also led to rioting in Canterbury, and the same pattern was seen elsewhere. The disruption of the Civil War greatly complicated but scarcely ended civic culture, more particularly the obligations of municipal government, notably poor relief, the maintenance of a basic infrastructure. But I think it's fair to say that the disruption of the war hit that civic culture very greatly, because there were tensions in any town between, not just between royalists and parliamentarians, but between those who were seen as more or less fervent in the cause, which was an issue on the parliamentary side, as was religious preference on the parliamentary side, whether Presbyterian or independent, what we might call Congregationalist. I think it's fair to say that the Civil War and experience and histories of the town was principally obviously remembered by families and individuals, as in that's why Uncle Fred hasn't got a leg. But there was also collective legacies. So, for example, 11th of May, the anniversary of the raising of the siege of Parliamentary held Taunton in 1645, a result which was seen as a great providential salvation against the royalists, certainly in Taunton, was celebrated with sermons preached there into the 1720s and an annual celebration held into the 1770s. One wonders whether in 125 years' time there will be a similar commemoration of what is be we're being told is a providential avoidance of an assassination lately. And politically, these events were a nonconformist radical expression of opposition there to the Tory corporation, for the nonconformists looked to the parliamentarians for their history. And these local politics were to go on playing a role, and indeed to, as it were, be fed by fresh contention. So, for example, the exclusion crisis from 1679 to 1681, too, the attempt in the latter years of Charles II's reign to exclude his brother, James Duke of York, from the succession. Was in a place like Taunton, very much linked with nonconformists who very much saw it as another stage of the struggle that they had experienced in the Civil War. In turn, the exclusion attempt failed in 1681. It was sworn down by Charles II. There was a Tory reaction for the rest of his reign, which lasted till 85, and that saw the destruction of nonconformist meeting houses. Conversely, in Worcester, long-standing royalist support thereafter, right through the late 17th century and 18th century, was in part a response to anger at damage by victorious Cromwellians in 1651, when Charles II was defeated. Cromwellian troops did a lot of damage. And this anger may have been a factor in 1786, when Thomas Jefferson and John Adams visited Worcester, complaining about a lack of support there for the victorious cause in the Civil War. They were on their travels, and Adams recorded that the two men had turned up. They'd gone to Edge Hill, a major battle in the Civil War, and then they'd gone to Worcester, and they were surprised that the locals weren't ecstatic that these were places where the cause of liberty had been defended. It's worth noting that when George III visited Worcester, he received, in contrast, a very good response. And only in 2018 did Worcester decide to mark the visit of the two future presidents of the United States, the second and the third one, with a statue. I think it's worth saying that that statue is a pretty awful one. One shouldn't wish for iconoclasm, it's a very bad thing. But somehow the modern cult of statues is so poor that one hopes very much that statues of a previous age, which people regard as unattractive, often for political reasons, are nevertheless maintained to remind them there is such a thing as aesthetic standards. I don't know whether that's allowed under the new government, those kind of reflections, but anyway, I make it. The civil wars led to a particular reworking of the histories of towns, but this was but part of the process by which history was supplemented and reworked. So Barnstaple, for example, had a chronicle written by the town clerk from 1586 to 1611. And similarly, the visual image of towns was increasingly set. The Civil War provided an opportunity through the news sheets and the news books to actually, and the woodcuts that went with them, to actually try and offer crude images and certainly to tell people what was happening in towns. And it was to you were to see more and more maps showing towns and giving people a visual idea of them, including their economic activities, or the major economic activities, as well as the town crests, which are less significant to us. Sir John Speed's book, The Theatre of the Empire of Great Britain, which came out in 1611 to 1612, contained 73 insert town plans, the majority of them of towns hitherto unmapped. Subsequently, it was necessary to show to decide whether, if you were doing subsequent maps after the civil wars, when there was a royalist reaction, whether you wanted to show what had happened in the civil war. During and after the war, the victorious parliamentarians certainly changed townscapes. They slighted a term of the period or rendered useless royalist defences, both town walls and in particular castles, permanently changing the town defences and landscape. For example, the castles at Corfe, at Kenilworth, at Pontefract, at Sheffield, at Skipton and Wallingford were among those slighted. Sometimes, for example, in Sheffield, the townspeople were consulted, but on the whole they weren't. Among the changes of the interregnum period, so, 1649 to 1660, 1649 is when Charles I has his head cut off, there was also the removal of royal iconography and extensive disruption and damage to the church, including the abolition of cathedrals. But Charles, by abolition, I don't mean the demolition. I mean that we've moved away from the Church of England at this period and its structure. In turn, on the 29th of May, 1660, Charles II entered London. And we can capture again John Evelyn's account. He described him that he entered with a triumph of horse and foot, I like that phrase, brandishing their swords and shouting with inexpressible joy, the way strewed with flowers, the bells ringing, the streets hung with tapestry, fountains running with wine, the mayor, aldermen and all the companies in their liveries, chains of gold, banners, lords and nobles, everyone clad in cloth of silver, gold and velvet, the windows and balconies all set with ladies, trumpets, music and myriads flocking the streets. I stood in the Strand and beheld it and blessed God. And all this was done without one drop of blood. It was the Lord's doing. Well, John Evelyn certainly was a supporter of the Restoration, as indeed were most people. Most people were heartily sick of the interregnum. But he doesn't capture the serious disruption it brought. This included an attack on quite a few individuals. I mean, obviously, the pursuit of the regicides, those that had signed Charles I's death penalty, the dismissal of prominent or even not prominent parliamentarians, for example, the postmaster of Sherborne, I noticed. And also there was, attacks on the towns involved. So the walls and defences of major towns that had backed Parliament, such as Coventry, Gloucester and Northampton, were slighted. I noticed this from the records. Upon the 10th day of July, 1662, the Lord Lieutenant of the County of Northampton and the Deputy Lord Lieutenant came to this town with some of the trained bands, pulled down the town walls and gates, and carried away all the arms and armour that was left in the town. And obviously, that was not to be reversed. This destruction made it harder to police entry and thus control vagrancy, but it also removed the military capability of these places. Furthermore, as part of the reaction against interregnum changes, Bradford, Leeds and Manchester lost the parliamentary seats they had gained for the 1653 Bare Bones Parliament. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that next time, if I may, because I think this is an interesting aspect of the political change of the period, which towns should be directly represented in Parliament. Anyway, Graham, I hope that was of some interest.
It was of tremendous interest, Jeremy. And as you talk, I mean, I'm just thinking about the way in which many of us think about the English Civil Wars as a series of set piece battles fought in battlefields like Edgehill, Marston Moore, Naseby, and so on. And listening to you, I wonder whether actually we focus too much on the set piece battles and not enough on the sieges. Of course, it's a difficult question, isn't it? Because often the outcomes of battlefields dictate who takes cities, and Marston Moore is an obvious case in point with York. But I wonder whether you would agree with the proposition that actually we should think of the English Civil War primarily as a series of sometimes quite localized actions about laying siege to and taking towns and cities, rather than armies moving across terrain and fighting pitched battles against one another.
Well, I think certainly you're absolutely right that sieges tend to be underplayed. And that's a theme also that military historians have more generally offered. I mean, for example, it's been argued quite strongly for the Middle Ages. And it's also been argued that this is linked to fascination with that the, as it were, the focus on battle is linked to fascination with cavalry and to fascination with the idea of a decisive day, whereas sieges are much more infantry activities and obviously tend to be over a period of time. So I agree with you very much. I think what I would say about battle is battle can provide the possibility for a siege, but you then need the siege often in order to confirm the result of the battle. Otherwise, as it were, it can be an ephemeral event. Separately, your comment on the localities is absolutely correct, because that's also true of battles as well as sieges, because the vast majority of those were local. And indeed, if one wants to extend this, many soldiers in the war were killed in skirmishes rather than battles, or were killed in small engagements, however you wish to define those. So I agree with you. And historians have a number of phrases for that. One of these phrases is small war. And I think that in general, people don't tend to focus sufficiently on small war. And I think you can see it across the board. And I think it's again a problem with a lot of the public commercial airport book stand, W.H. Smith's Penguins, rather crude form of military history, that they often have this rather glib account, rather than drilling down and looking at the actual substantive significance of small war. So yes, I agree with you completely.
And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the nature of what tended to make towns either parliamentarian or royalist. And I'm aware that you know, any generalization leads to the pointing out that there are exceptions to rules. But the general impression I get is that, you know, if the town is a port, it's much more likely to be on the parliamentarian side. If the town or city has a cathedral, then it's much more likely to be on the royalist side. If it's in the southeast, it's much more likely to be parliamentarian. If it's in the southwest, it's much more likely to be royalist. These are generalizations, but are they broadly true?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think you've got to be careful on the cathedral one. Obviously, London and Norwich both had cathedrals, as did Canterbury. What I would say is there is a economic aspect to it, yes, that, as you correctly say, port cities tended to be parliamentarian, as indeed did towns that were industrial. But I think one has to be careful about how one thinks of economic groups. I mean, when I was young, there was the very crude socioeconomic causation offered by Christopher Hill, the Master of Balliol, of course, a famous Marxist. And because it was published in a popular format, and it was, as it were, apparently the right history for the 1960s and 70s, so it was extensively propagated. I think now people might be more apt to focus on religion and not to see that simply as a product of economic interest, and to argue that that was a fundamental division. They're also more likely to focus on tensions within urban communities. And where a town was 2 weeks after, as it were, fighting started, if one wants to use that as a crude term, does not necessarily indicate what might have happened if somebody else hadn't moved quickly, either within the town or outside it, in order to seize control. And the same point can be made about town loyalties during the Glorious Revolution of 1688 to 89. So that, for example, if you take Canterbury, there clearly was support for the crown in Canterbury. There was support for the crown in London or in Westminster. But what's crucial is what happens in the early days. And I think this is a very important point, because so often people argue from results to causes, and that's very low grade. I mean, it's the standard form in which people often discuss matters, but it's a very low grade matter, because it assumes that that result was inevitable, and it tends to downplay the contingent element of it.
Well, Luke, this is a fascinating subject, and I'm very sorry we're out of time, but we will carry on next time with towns in the period of the interregnum and restoration. But for now, Jeremy Back, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.